Should Florida get rid of mandatory minimum sentences for drug offenses? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. State Senator Jeff Brandis has brought a bill to the Florida legislature to tackle the issues of criminal justice reform. His proposal is similar to one Congress has worked on that removes minimum drug sentences. We'll discuss how this could save taxpayers millions and reduce pressure on an overburdened prison system. Also, hate groups are on the rise according to the Southern Poverty Law Center. What are the parameters for being listed as a hate group, and how many are there in South Florida? And finally, baseball spring training is underway, but Marlins Park is going to be filled with middle schoolers and high schoolers for a culinary competition. We're going to tickle the taste buds this lunch hour and discuss improving culinary training in schools, as well as the recipes the students are preparing. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Florida prisons are stretched beyond capacity. Wardens are asking for more money to hire more guards, provide better education and mental health services to the prisoners. There is a bill in the Florida Senate that could help with some of the capacity issues. Republican State Senator Jeff Brandis wants to remove minimum drug sentences. And Brandis is also behind the legislation in the Senate, which would remove the ban on smokable medical marijuana. Senator Brandis joins us now. The legislative session, by the way, begins March 5th. Senator Brandis, such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Great. Thanks to be with you.
And by the way, if you have a question for the senator about criminal justice reform or the issue of smokable medical marijuana, give us a call, 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-9576. You can also post your questions on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Senator, you brought back Senate Bill 642. This is the Florida First Step Act. Why is criminal justice reform important to you this time around?
So I don't know if you've watched, but last week we had the wardens from the variety of different institutions on, and what they were telling was basically that the prison system is in dire shape, that they can't find prison guards, that they can't find teachers, that their prisons are literally falling down and water's coming into their roofs, all kinds of problems there. We hear the same things from essentially all the institutions, and the criminal justice system is slowly grinding to a halt.
So it's basically, is this just about trying to reduce the number of prisoners that we have that maybe that'll help us, in cost, but maybe take a little bit of the burden off of the wardens?
Well, I think that's part of it. I think the simple truth is that Florida really is behind the curve as far as the best practices from around the country and the criminal justice system. And so what we're simply asking people to do is let's look at the data, let's look at the best practices, and let's begin to implement some of those in Florida. That's really what the First Step Act is all about. It's beginning to allow judges to act like judges, to have some discretion, to look at people on an individual basis, to look at cases on an individual basis, and to make some decisions based on that. Unfortunately, decades ago, the legislature removed that discretion from judges, and we basically could have a robot doing what the judges do today, which is, look at the chart, follow the chart, issue the sentence. That isn't justice, in my opinion. For many of these people, we're treating drug mules just like we are drug kingpins, and we aren't looking at the individual facts of the case.
It goes back to, what we saw over, 20, 30 years ago when there was just seemed to be a national push to get tough on crime and basically to have zero tolerance towards crime. And so there was a push for bigger sentences and just, as you said, almost put it on like robotic mode and just allow the system to put people through. Do you think that that's changing culturally, that we're saying, wait a second, we can't just treat everybody. There's no one size fits all, and maybe we should rethink this?
I think that's exactly what I'm saying. I think at the end of the day, we're talking about people who have different circumstances, come from different places. Yes, sometimes they've done some horrible things. Sometimes they've done some things that we're mad at them for, and we need to address that. But also we need to look at them in the course of what's ultimately going to be the best for this individual to help them with their life and get them back on the right path. The simple truth is about 95% of your inmates inside of Florida's prisons are ultimately going to get out someday. Of those, we need them to be better prepared for life when they do get out. Yes, there's a punitive phase to their punishment, but there's also a recuperation our goal is to get them prepared to reenter society a better person, ready to be prepared for the life challenges that lie ahead, recognizing that they're not always going to be in prison. So how are we doing that? Today, we're not. We've basically turned the criminal justice system and, frankly, the Department of Corrections into the Department of Warehousing.
Again, the number is 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-9576. If you have a question for Senator Brandis, we're talking about criminal justice reform. We'll also talk a little bit about smokable medical marijuana as well. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Senator, Congress has been working on this as well. How much of the work they've done has gone into the work you're trying to do with this bill?
I think it really does help set the tone and helps both members of both parties feel comfortable having the conversation about criminal justice reform. I think the exciting thing about what Congress did was basically in an overwhelming bipartisan fashion, say it's okay to have a conversation about criminal justice reform, that our forefathers didn't get it right, that they made some mistakes when they were doing some of this, and that it, you know, what we can do is try to set the right tone going forward. So things that were included in the federal bill that are included in mine are just a couple, but very important. One, they look at mandatory minimums and allowing for downward departure. I think that's incredibly important. Two, they talk about inmates being sentenced close to home. So in the federal act, it's 500 miles. In ours, it's 150 miles. Because we know is that inmates who are sentenced close to home, they're able to maintain that family connection. Because when they get out, it's important that they be able to get back and be reintegrated back into society. And if you're from my district, which is Pinellas County, if you get sentenced to prison, you're largely going to serve that time in the panhandle, hours away from your family. Sometimes it's a day and a half trip to get up to there, you know, to spend a few hours with your family members. And that's just too far. We need to be able to allow that family connection. Yes, we understand what you've done requires time to be served in prison, but that doesn't mean you should be completely removed from your kids, completely removed from that family interaction that's so important when it's time to reintegrate you back into society on the back end.
And I'm wondering if you spend some time with victims' rights groups, advocates, on this issue, what they've said to you about this, because I'm just hearing some of the same stuff I've heard from them.
Yeah, no, when I've talked to kids of incarcerated parents, and they tell you how difficult it is to see dad twice a year, when they don't have that connection, and it ripples, the ripple effects through society are just incredible. So how can we do simple things like house people closer to home that still keeps them removed from society? Prison still is a challenging and difficult place to go through, but it shouldn't be so punitive that we're forcing you to be completely away from your family and disconnecting your kids, your spouse from you, in such a way that you don't maintain those family connections, because eventually you are going to get out.
We did get a question on Twitter. This from Gloria Romero writes, what legislative initiative this session, if any, is targeting best practices to address recidivism?
So I think we've got a couple of things. We've been studying this for years, but really we think there's a few different strategies that we have to look at. One is diversion. How do we divert people at the front end? So if we can keep people out of this, there's got to be an off-ramp to prison. So if somebody's struggling with addiction, how are we making sure that we're putting a drug court in their community so that they can go through the drug court and not maybe go to prison for that? What are we doing with veterans so we can have a veteran court? We know those work. We have mental health issues. Taking somebody with a severe mental illness and putting them in prison doesn't make those people better. They don't get better being locked in a cell with other people with mental health issues. So how can we focus on diversion in the front end? We also know that a best practice is helping people transition back into society in a better way. So today, if you're released from prison, if you don't have a family to go back to, we give you essentially $50 and a bus pass, and we leave you outside the prison door and say, good luck with life. What happens to those individuals is some of them within 72 hours will be homeless. They'll be committing other crimes. They'll because there's no reintegration, because there's no making sure that they have a job, they have a family, they have a house to go back to, they have a halfway house to get reconnected to. How do we do a better job in transitioning people on the back end? And then there's the best practices of our overall criminal punishment code. So we think over this summer, we should spend the entire summer doing a top to bottom review of our criminal punishment code and saying, what are the best practices that go into each one of those? So I think there's a variety of things we can do, but those are three simple things: focus on diversion, focus on transition, focus on the criminal punishment code, and bring best practices into all three.
I wonder if you heard from anyone who says, you know what, I'm worried about public safety. And if they, you know, come out and say, look, this sounds like you could be endangering public safety by reducing criminal sentences. Have you heard from anybody who said that?
Well, I think the interesting thing is, find me the research that says that mandatory minimums work. Find me the research that shows that when we take discretion away from judges, that the community is better off. The truth is, there isn't that research doesn't exist. You've seen multiple states move away from mandatory minimums. Now, I'm not saying that you shouldn't give some judges some guidance as far as the range of what that sentence should be. I think you should. But I think you should allow judges to be judges. Legislators in Florida meet 60 days out of the year. They have no clue about the individual facts of virtually any case in the state of Florida. But all of these people come with a different path. All of these people have a reason. There's some underlying reason, something going on that could be better addressed by letting the judge tailor the sentence to that specific crime. And to me, individuals who are in prison system should have an incentive to better themselves. Florida has essentially removed that incentive to better yourself while you're in prison, because we've set a hard cap of 85%. You're going to serve 85% of that sentence, period. Even if you go get a GED, even if you've never had a disciplinary review while you've been in prison, we've removed all the incentive for people to be better while they're in prison. Because I think if we looked at the system, we said, what's the best practice? We should look at the incentive structure all along the way for people to better themselves while they're in the prison system, and then when they get out of the prison system, to stay on the right path so they don't get back into the system.
We're talking with State Senator Jeff Brandis, representing Florida's 24th District. Senator Brandis has introduced the Florida First Step Act, removing mandatory minimum sentences on drug offenses. A new report released this week from the James Madison Institute endorsed the proposal, finding that it could save Floridian taxpayers millions. Senator, the other thing, I mean, going back to what you said a little while ago in that conversation with wardens, and they're telling you what they need. Let's look at one specific issue, is they need to hire more people. And specifically guards, you know, the folks running the prison itself, they're having a hard time recruiting. They're having a hard time keeping. So how does this help? And what would you think would be a good solution to try to resolve that?
So you're right. They're in crisis. The prison system in Florida is in crisis right now. I've said that we're about one federal judge away from losing control of our criminal justice system, and having the federal government come in and begin to spend the hardworking taxpayer money of Florida on the system, because they recognize that the legislature has essentially failed in its duty for criminal justice system, having an appropriate prison system. And what you heard from wardens is exactly that, is that we can't hire prison guards, is that even at our reentry centers, where we have 1,200 inmates, we have no teacher. We haven't had a teacher there for 7 months. That many of the prison systems throughout Florida have no instruction going on, have no teachers in the prison systems, that essentially the inmates do their chores and go have yard time, but there's nothing for them to occupy their time during the regular day, that the guards are being asked to stay over their regular shifts, that we've moved from 8-hour shifts to 12-hour shifts in many facilities. And so sometimes guards are working 16, 18-hour days, getting off, sleeping in a FEMA trailer during their off time, and then coming back on. And then if they refuse to work their days off, they're being written up. This is not sustainable. The Florida prison system is in crisis, and we know this. Luckily, we brought in a new head of the Department of Corrections, Secretary Hinch, who was the former head of the federal prison system, to help bring some new ideas to the table. But it's an all hands on deck situation in the criminal justice system in Florida, and specifically in the prison system.
The number again, 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. You can always send your question, as we've already gotten a couple, on Twitter or Facebook at WLRN Sundial. Talking about criminal justice reform, but also wanted to move over now to the issue of smokable medical marijuana. The governor has given the legislature till March 15th to get something to his desk. He wants to end the ban on smokable medical marijuana. Senator, where do you stand on this?
Oh, I'm for smokable medical marijuana. I think, I filed a bill back in 2017 that would have addressed this. And now I filed the bill again this year to address this issue. But we're in conversations with our friends in the Florida House. We're making good progress. I would expect that we'll have a final product in the next 2 weeks. But we're very close.
Why are we having this debate right now when a couple of years ago the voters overwhelmingly said, we want medical marijuana, and that would be part of it. But, you know, it's been a challenge to get Tallahassee to give, or at least, again, critics will say it's been tough to get Tallahassee to give the voters what they asked for.
I agree. And that's why I, back in 2017, when they passed the implementing bill that actually set up the structure of how medical marijuana would look in Florida, I voted against it. I didn't think it was what the voters supported. I've had an amendment that we were able to get 19 votes for on the Senate floor. We needed 21 for it to pass, but we were able to get 19. That would have changed the structure dramatically. Florida has a system that is essentially a state-approved drug cartel. We have a handful of people who have gotten licenses. Some of them had never had a desire to grow a potted plant of marijuana, but once they got a license, they immediately flipped it to a out-of-state company. And these are some of the biggest marijuana companies in the country. And they're, you know, some of these licenses have sold for $50 or $80 million, and they never grew a plant of marijuana or a medical marijuana when they got the licenses. Oh, and by the way, none of my constituents qualified to get a license to grow because the qualification standard when they originally set this was that you had to be in the nursery business for 30 years in Florida to qualify for a license. So it was just pure crony capitalism, the worst type of legislation that I've seen in the process. And what we've done is made a handful of families very, very wealthy. Meanwhile, patients were left to suffer, and that's unacceptable.
But there is a contingency of lawmakers who just, they're anti-marijuana, and they will fight it. You know who they are. But, you know, I'm curious as if you've had those conversations, you know, what are they like, and how do you convince somebody? But the voter said this is what they've asked for.
Well, I think two things. One, you tell them, look, voters overwhelmingly supported this. There's 71, 72% of voters supported medical marijuana. You just need to implement what the voters have done. Two, you do what Governor Ron DeSantis has done, which is say, here, look, he's a former legislator. He understands what this is like. He was in Congress. He says, legislature, you have a job to do. Go do your job, but I'm setting a hard deadline. And if you don't do your job, I'm pulling out of the court decisions. And it will be, you know, Wild West for medical marijuana in Florida. So he has given the legislature a hard cap. He said, go back and do your job. Here's what I expect you to do. And that has changed the entire tone in Tallahassee right now. And I think this is why you're seeing this medical marijuana bill move as fast as it is, and why there is the type of resources being spent on addressing this issue as quickly as it's going to get done this year. But it's that type of leadership that it takes sometimes in this process.
You know, looking at a couple of the concerns, obviously, and we've heard from listeners as well, is, you know, making sure that, you know, that we keep it out of the hands of anyone under the age of 18. Another one was about dosage of smokable medical marijuana. This is, you know, the consumption that doctors really can't control. How do you get around those, or how do you deal with those issues, I think is a better way to put it.
Well, I think the question is, it's an access issue, right? So to me, I, at least in the Senate bill, we allow kids under we allow people, everyone to have access. But for those that are under 18, there's a special process. They have to have two physicians. One has to be a pediatrician. And they can only access this product if it's the most effective means for delivery to that individual. To me, that means that maybe of the 21 million Floridians, only 3 or 4 would even qualify under the Senate provision of, you know, most effective and having two physicians sign off. But I think the Constitution, frankly, requires access. It doesn't say that the legislature has the authority to set a prohibition on people under 18. What it does say is they have to provide a pathway, but can say that pathway can be, that hurdle can be very high. And I think what we've done is set a very high hurdle in the Senate bill.
He is Republican State Senator Jeff Brandis, representing Florida's 24th District. Senator, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for the time.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
And again, talking about issues like getting rid of the mandatory minimum sentences on drug offenses, also talking about smokable medical marijuana. Just a reminder that the Florida legislature will begin its new session, this year's session, on March 5th. And we will give you full coverage week by week as lawmakers debate all of these issues and more. Well, still to come, why are hate groups on the rise in South Florida? We got a new report we're going to check out coming up next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Hate groups are on the rise nationwide. Florida has the third most, and there are quite a few in South Florida. According to the newly released The Intelligence Report from the Southern Poverty Law Center, there's been a 30% increase of hate groups across the country over the past 4 years. Now, these groups are becoming increasingly radicalized, and as a result, we've seen more hate crimes and more violence, from a shooting at a yoga studio in Tallahassee to the mailing of pipe bombs from a man in Aventura. The Southern Poverty Law Center is tracking these groups and researching the causes behind their increased radicalization. Heidi Byrick is the director of the Intelligence Report, and she joins us now to talk about it. Heidi Byrick, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
What does the Southern Poverty Law Center believe are some of the reasons, the contributing factors to the expansion of hate groups across the country these last 4 years?
Well, there's a couple things that we would point to as being driving factors. One is just the existence of the online space, which allows people to be radicalized into extremist propaganda in ways that were never possible before in history. We've had quite a few notable extremists like Dylan Roof, who shot up that black church in Charleston, who learned everything about hating black people in that case from the web. So that's the first factor. And the second is that we lay a lot of this at the feet of the Trump administration, which has energized white supremacists by playing to issues that they get riled up about, being anti-immigrant, being anti-Muslim. Those kinds of things are also something that has contributed to rising ranks in these groups, as they feel like they have more of a stake in the political system and should get involved.
So we've seen this expansion. The report talks about expansion nationwide, but what have you seen in Florida, and specifically South Florida?
Yeah, well, Florida actually, and unfortunately, has been a place where hate groups have for a long time found a home. The oldest hate site on the web is actually in West Palm Beach. It's an outfit called Stormfront that we list as a hate group, and this is something that's been there since the mid-1990s. If you take Florida's population, which is obviously Florida is one of the three largest states in the U.S., into account, Florida still is sort of on the gradient to having more hate groups per capita than half of the states in the United States. So I think that's important. In terms of South Florida, you have a mix of all kinds of organizations. You have neo-Nazi groups like Stormfront, which I mentioned. You have the Proud Boys, which is this sort of thuggish street fighting group that describes itself as Islamophobic. You also have anti-Muslim groups in that area and quite a few organizations that we consider to be hate groups that are black nationalist groups.
So looking through the map, one of the things that I wanted to ask you is you see all these groups, you have them listed where they're, you know, what parts of the state, what parts of the country you could find them, and information about each group. But how many of those groups, I guess, would be the best way to ask you is, are active or are actually dangerous, a threat? And how many of them are just, you know, that's a person or a group of people there, but they're just there?
It's a fair question. So we don't put groups on our list because they're violent. That said, a large chunk of the organizations on our group have had members who engage in violence, in particular neo-Nazi groups and skinhead groups. The reason we don't list on the basis of violence is because we have far too many situations where an organization whose members are just pumping out bigoted or hateful propaganda of some sort, anti-Semitic propaganda, that material ultimately becomes an inspiration for someone to commit an act of violence. Dylann Roof is a classic example of that. As I mentioned, he wasn't a member of a hate group, and he was radicalized online, but he was reading material from white supremacist groups that didn't have a track record of violence. They end up inspiring that kind of violence. So we're actually concerned about all the groups on this list because all of them in some way target a population, whether it may be Jews, African-Americans, white people, and demean them and vilify them. And that can give someone an excuse for committing a hate crime. And that's why we do this based on ideology.
So the KKK has a long history in South Florida. And one of the interesting things is, you know, this past month we were, you know, for our book club, we were actually talking about a book called The Jews of Key West. And part of that history, they looked at how the KKK had its, had, I guess, not to say a resurgence, but they had a growth in the earlier part of the 20th century. And I'm wondering, have we seen a resurgence of that group, with the alt-right movement growing?
Actually, the number of Klan groups has been dropping really hard for the last 3 years. So as you mentioned in the opening, over 4 years, we've seen a 30% increase in the number of hate groups. We've seen a massive decline in the number of Klan groups over that time. And the reason is this, that alt-right formation, these kind of younger millennial racists who have come about in recent years, they're really not attracted to the Klan's, I don't know how to say this, almost look or fashion. They don't like the hoods. They don't like the kind of weird symbolism and titles. Most of these younger racists are in groups that where they dress and they act like someone, anybody you might see, person in khakis and a polo shirt. And so we've really seen a massive decline in what is the oldest hate group in America, right, established after the Civil War, the Klan, and the one that's been responsible for so much violence over the years. It seems to have finally lost an audience.
Do we find white supremacist groups growing in areas where you have a large immigrant population like South Florida?
You do. They are located in those kinds of areas, so they're definitely taking advantage of increasing diversity. But the sad fact is the biggest white supremacist groups and neo-Nazi groups, whether it's the National Socialist Movement or something like Patriot Front, this is a group that puts racist flyers up on college campuses, you find them everywhere in the country now. That's the issue. They are trying to recruit in every single place that they can get into, with immigrant communities or without immigrant communities. And so there's just a lot of recruitment efforts on the part of these groups, and it's paying off for them by growing memberships.
Is that related to, you know, I guess, access online, social media, digital access, things like that?
There's no question. I mean, look, the rallies at Charlottesville, right, which led to Heather Heyer's death, were completely organized off a Facebook page and off of a thing called Discord, which is a gaming chat app. It's almost like you can't distinguish between online and offline activism. The two bleed into each other. These groups use the online space to teach people their beliefs and to set up events and to get people to their events. And then that ultimately spills over into real world activity. And then what happens in the real world, they take photographs, videos, and whatnot. They use that to start the cycle all the way over again. The web has just made it much easier to do everything that these groups are trying to do.
So does that mean that, you know, most of your tracking of these groups is online?
Yes. I mean, we have several researchers who spend hours and hours and hours on hate sites, but also on mainstream platforms like Facebook, like Twitter, looking at people who have PayPal accounts, seeing what they're selling on Amazon. And then there's also the hate sites themselves, where we spend a lot of time looking at material and posting. But we have to do both now, because you actually find these people in both places. It's not like they're confined to like a hate forum like they were maybe 10 years ago.
And yeah, the other thing too is, what about the dark web? I mean, how much time are they spending on just your regular social media sites everybody else is on, and how many of them are moving to the dark web to I guess hide some of their activity?
Well, that is a hard question to answer, because it's hard to track people in the dark web. You know, the thing about these organizations that you have to keep in mind is they are actually, from their perspective, political organizations that are building memberships. And the dark web doesn't serve you well to do that. You need to be in the public space where people can find you if you want to recruit members and get membership dues. So our feeling is that probably most of the activity happens in the part of the web that all of us can see. And we know that it's very angering to these groups when they get deplatformed, when they lose a Facebook page or a Twitter account. And their anger at that happening, when they post hateful material that violates community standards or terms of service, shows how much they need access to the general public. It's like oxygen to keep them going.
And part of that helps their funding as well.
It's their funding, it's their membership, it's the size of their rallies. So although they might be communicating in various ways that we can't see through the dark web or direct messaging, at the end of the day, they can't build their ranks without access to the wider web.
I'm talking with Heidi Byrick. She leads the Intelligence Project for the Southern Poverty Law Center. The newly released intelligence report shows an increase of hate groups across the United States, 30% increase over the last 4 years, many of which are based here in South Florida. Now, the report details some of the political reasons for the expansion of hate groups nationwide and, of course, concerns for future violence that they may bring. So, Heidi Byrick, it's important to discern how the Southern Poverty Law Center defines what a hate group is. So what are the primary characteristics that would list them or get them on the list for you?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, we're looking at the ideology of the group, the statements of its leaders, what its official positions are. And what we're looking for is, does that organization vilify, demean, consider lesser an entire other population based on their inherent characteristics? So what I mean by that is, for example, do they propagate ideas like all black people are more criminal or have lower IQ, or LGBT people should be thrown in jail for engaging in same-sex relationships, or Jews are masterminds behind some kind of conspiracy to bring immigrants to the United States and should be killed? That's literally what Robert Bowers, who shot those people at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, believed. We're looking for that kind of a pattern. And the key thing is, does the group consider all the members of that other population to be lesser? This is actually almost exactly the way the FBI decides whether something is a hate group, whether or not the person targeted an entire group used a slur against Jews or African Americans in an attack. You can find those two definitions on our website at splcenter.org if you want to look at them side by side.
And one of the things right now, as you know, there are three groups suing the center for labeling them as hate groups for defamation of character. One of them, and you talked about a moment ago, the Proud Boys Club. This was started a couple of years ago in support of the Trump presidency, and they've been linked to the Charlottesville Unite the Right rally, and most recently, they provided security and support to Roger Stone following his arrest in Fort Lauderdale. What do you say in response to the organization justifying your label?
Well, I mean, look, anybody can file a lawsuit. Our view on this is that we stand by our listing 100%, that we think it's absolutely fair to call the Proud Boys a hate group, both by the statements of their former leader, who has now stepped down, Gavin McInnes. He actually said at one point, I think it's fair to characterize me as an Islamophobe. In other words, somebody who hates Muslims. And I think that kind of tells you everything you need to know in terms of the listing.
Is there any concern about the center being labeled as a partisan organization when you think about the fact that a lot of these groups are linked to conservative policies or conservative individuals?
You know, I get asked that question a lot, and I think to myself that, for example, where that's usually laid at the feet are some of the groups that we list as anti-LGBT. And the groups that we list in that category are groups that say things like gay men, all gay men, are more likely to be pedophiles and molest children. Or they're groups that advocate for people to be sent to jail using sodomy laws, basically some old school persecution against gay and lesbians. And I have to say that I don't understand how that could be conservative. In this case, what you're doing is simply lying when you're talking about pedophilia or molestation, or you're advocating for one of the most barbarous policies that the world is throwing off. And so I don't think of that as conservative. And I would guess that most conservatives don't think about upholding those ideas as being conservative.
The other thing interesting about this report, too, is that you look at lawmakers with links to extremist organizations. One of them is a Florida congressman, Matt Gaetz. He invited Chuck Johnson to President Trump's State of the Union address. Johnson is an avowed white nationalist that started the web platform WeSearcher, used for crowdfunding alt-right groups. Why is it important for the Intelligence Project to track these lawmakers' connections And what does it say about potential influence on policy?
Well, I mean, this is where it becomes really concerning, because now you don't have a fringe group that might be saying hateful things, maybe inspires hate crimes or something like that. But once you get close to lawmakers, or lawmakers are hanging out with members of hate groups, it can affect policy, which is terrifying. It can also give a veneer of legitimacy to extremist ideas and groups. Chuck Johnson is a Holocaust denier, and his site WeSearcher was used to raise money, for example, for a neo-Nazi who ran a trolling campaign against a Jewish woman in Whitefish, Montana. You know, I expect more out of our elected officials, one, to denounce hate, and certainly not to have connections to groups like that. So when we see that kind of mainstreaming, it's really scary and unfortunate. We've seen far too much of it, frankly, in this administration.
Real briefly, if you could, I wanted to ask you about one particular case that very close to home here is the case of Cesar Sayoc. He was the gentleman who was arrested for sending pipe bombs to numerous members of the media and Congress. Do we know if he was connected to a specific hate group, or is he acting as an individual? This may go to the question of, are these groups becoming more violent, or is it just the message that's, you know, I guess, influencing people to act out individually?
Well, we haven't found any indication. As far as I know, there isn't one that Sayoc was connected to any particular group, but he clearly was keyed in on messaging about Trump's enemies. He knew particular anti-immigrant groups. He knew he had targeted George Soros, the financier who funds liberal groups, who had been targeted by some in the conservative world as being sort of a menace to society. And most likely he was just reading online propaganda, of which there's far too much of, that target these same individuals. The Coast Guard person who was arrested last week, Hassan, also had a hit list, right, that he had drawn up of, in that case, Donald Trump's enemies. We don't think he was connected to any groups. At least he's not in our files, even though he says he's been a white supremacist for 30 years. But reading this stuff online gives you all you need to know to come up with an enemies list like that. And that's why we're so concerned about the online world. I mean, a lot of the domestic terrorist acts that we've had, and have been a lot by white supremacists, the individual involved was not a card-carrying member of a group. They were just somebody who sucked in the information online and then decided to act on their own.
Heidi Byrick again leads the Intelligence Project for the Southern Poverty Law Center. They have a new report out that shows that hate groups across the United States have increased 30% over the last 4 years. By the way, they have a map, so you can look at state by state where these groups are, what those groups are, exactly where they're located. Heidi Byrick, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for the time.
I appreciate being on.
Well, still to come, we're going to change things up because, you know, a lot of heavy stuff to talk about there. And lighten things up and, you know, get the taste buds going. We're going to talk about a culinary competition here in Miami-Dade County. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Middle school and high school students with culinary ambitions are going to be gathering at Marlins Park this week to participate in the Education Fund's Top Chef competition, Taste of Education. The 30 teams come from 17 culinary programs in Miami-Dade County Public Schools. They'll be making scrumptious bites like shrimp and grits, ceviche, jerk cranberry meatballs, and barbecue sliders. Yeah, I'm glad we do this show at lunchtime, right? And they will be judged by top South Florida chefs. The teams are competing for $20,000 in top prizes that will be awarded to the school's culinary program. Joining us now is pastry chef Letty Alvarez, who's the founder of LA Sweets in Miami Lakes. Chef Alvarez, such a pleasure.
My pleasure to be here, guys. Thank you.
Thank you for being here. Also joining us is Coral Gables senior high teacher Mercy Vera, and senior student at the school, Kelvis Colina. Great to have both of you. Mercy, Kelvis, welcome to the program.
Hey, how you doing?
Great to have you. And once again, if you want to attend and taste some of the dishes, it is at 6 p.m. on Wednesday at Marlins Park. You can find ticket information on our social media pages at WLRN Sundial. Chef Letty, let me start with you. Briefly, tell us about the Education Fund's Top Chef competition. I said who's going to be involved or how many people are going to be involved, but kind of give us a rundown of what's going to happen.
Well, it is the Taste of Education, and it is being hosted by the Education Fund, which is being sponsored by Sposnik Insurance. So this is the first year that I'm actually judging. I'm a newbie to the experience. I believe that Mercy probably has more information coming from the teacher perspective, but from what I've been told, it's an amazing opportunity to taste 30 dishes.
Have you ever judged?
I've judged several competitions.
Okay.
Yeah.
Have you ever judged students?
No, I've never judged students.
Okay.
So this will be a first, but I am looking forward to it.
All right. Mercy, tell us real quickly, how's the competition set up? And because I mentioned how many teams are involved.
Well, this will be my fifth year with the Education Fund, and it is super exciting for the students. In the past, they had actually judges going around and tasting all the different types of dishes that the students were making. But in the last past 2 years, they have the judges taste the dishes first, and then they have like a People's Choice Award later on at 6 o'clock when it's open to the public, because the event is from 6 to 8:30, and then they can actually go ahead and taste all the dishes, and then they can vote themselves individually. It's an incredible event for the students and, of course, for the teachers. It's a lot of work and a lot of stress, but it's all worth it in the end.
And how do you get the students prepared for a competition? I mean, I think high school students are used to competition, whether it's sports or band or anything like that. But this culinary competition, how do you get them ready?
Well, at the present moment, we've been starting since Friday because we're feeding about 500 individuals that will be coming and trying everything. But the way that I actually do it is I have the kids go ahead and research recipes, and then we as a class together decide on what is going to work out better for us, because also funding comes a lot involved in what kind of dishes we can make. Of course, we can't all make foie gras and filet mignon. We don't have the funding for that. But the Education Fund does pay for the groceries for all the event and for all the recipes.
Yeah.
So we do it like that. And then we start doing it in segments during class. The kids start preparing, like, for example, our dish. One of the two dishes that we will be doing are, the first dish is a shredded barbecue beef on top of a sweet plantain mash with a roasted corn salsa. And then the second dish is a dulce de fruta bomba, which is a marmalade of papaya with goat cheese balls, goes...
Oh my goodness! All right, no, I'm enjoying just listening to this. Kelvis, let me bring you in. Is this the first culinary competition you've been part of?
No, this isn't my first one. I was actually part of another one at Johnson and Wales, where my team competed to see if we would go to state.
And what was it like? What's it like doing these a culinary competition?
Oh, it's stressful. I'll tell you, it's a lot of practice. You go through the recipe again and again and again until it's embedded in your brain, and until you see the recipe in front of you and you can just do it by memory. And it's a fun team building exercise because you got to trust your teammates to know what they're doing. If not,
yeah. And by the way, how many teammates do you have? How many people per team?
There's going to be 3 people per team.
Okay. And so I take it that one person's in charge, or is it the teacher?
No, the team tries to work like a well-oiled machine as best we can. We have to manage ourselves. That's one of the challenges.
Yeah. Chef Letty, I mean, again, this is the first time you're judging students. But, I mean, you know, when you're judging a competition, what are some of the things that you look at? Is it kind of like, you know, look, I don't know. I always think about those television shows I love to watch. But is it like that? You're looking at presentation?
It's very similar to that. You are looking for creativity with a flavor profile. You're looking for presentation. You're looking for plating. But what I always look for is team camaraderie. And to see how well they can sell their dish. Because, you know, in the real world, it's a lot of work. And I just want to put it out there for you, Kelvis, that if you think school is hard right now and competitions are hard, I can tell you when you own your own restaurant and operate it, it is 1,000 times harder. And that day in and day out repetition is what's needed to succeed.
All right, Kelvis, you're getting a little bit of life lesson as well as getting ready for your competition. It's already stressful enough. Again, talking with Chef Letty Alvarez, also talking with Coral Gables senior high teacher Mercy Veda and senior student at the school, Kelvis Golina. They'll be part of the Education Fund's Top Chef competition. It's called Taste of Education. Now, the competition for high school students to showcase their best stuff, you can taste the students' dishes at 6 o'clock at Marlins Park. You can get ticket information on our website, on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Mercy, something you said just a little while ago is very interesting. Look, there's a big cash prize for this, and that's going to help fund culinary programs at the schools. And I wondered, I always hear about teachers who sometimes have to spend their own money to get just the students the basic supplies. I can't imagine for teaching culinary, that's a lot of supplies.
Yes, it is. And again, Dade County Public Schools
provides
the best supplies.
Mercy, if I can get closer to the phone for me, please.
Yes. Dade County Public Schools really tries to
okay, I'm having a little bit of trouble hearing you. So, if you could just go ahead and you might be on speakerphone. I'm not sure, but if you could just get off of that.
No, can you hear me now?
Yeah, there you are. Go
yes,
ahead.
Yes, there we go. The Dade County Public Schools really tries to fund.
Do you have a radio? Do you have a radio on?
No.
Okay, there you are. There you are. Okay, no, now you're clear. Go ahead. I'm sorry about that.
No worries. We're used to it, this is a life thing with us. We do a lot of cooking shows. That's what I call it here. I'm on a cooking show constantly, so I'm ready to repeat over and over.
No problem. There you go.
But Dade County Public Schools does try to fund us as best as they can. You know, there's a lot of elective programs here, so it's really hard. So communities like Community Help and organizations like the Education Fund that give us money like they do to fund these programs are really how these programs exist. If not, it would be very, very, very difficult for the kids to really understand and learn what it's like to actually work in the industry, and especially for supplies, not so much for pots and pans and stoves and stuff like that, but you need the actual ingredients. And I couldn't do it without the Education Foundation and other community leaders and supports that we have. If not, they would be learning how to make different styles of peanut butter and jelly throughout the whole year.
And what does a competition like this teach them? How does it get them ready?
Well, it teaches them, first of all, it teaches them about working together as a team, which is very important. You know, with today's generation, they're all caught up in the phone. So this is a very tactile industry. So it also teaches them about different foods, how to eat properly and explore their taste buds. And, it gets them out there, it's hard for them,
right,
to get a kid to eat just a piece of broccoli, nevertheless a sweet plantain hash or goat cheese balls.
Real quickly. Hey, listen, get me to eat broccoli. I need to do that. Kelvis, real quickly, what has all of this been for you? What has it meant to you? And what has it taught you?
It's taught me how to not eat cup noodles during college, but it's really taught me teamwork, and it's helped me get a creative outlet that I've never had before. I'm not much of an artist, but with culinary, I can, when I'm presenting a dish and when I'm plating, it's taught me like a new like respect for food that I've never had before, and a new understanding of eating.
No, you know what? And I think as your teacher said, it's you learn not just about the work that goes behind it, but you have a different respect for the food. Chef Alvarez, to finish up real quickly, is what advice do you give students as they get ready for a competition to get mentally ready?
My advice would be to just, stay steady, because not everything will go your way the day of competition. Things usually go wrong, especially during competitions. But if you just keep a level head, you work through the problem, you will always come up on top.
That's what makes the cooking show so much fun to watch, is something goes wrong. Not that I want anything to go wrong for any of the students. I wish all of them the best of luck. Chef Letty Alvarez, again, joining us, Coral Gables senior high teacher Mercy Vera and senior student at the school, Kelvis Galina. Again, it's called Taste of Education, a culinary competition. The high schoolers are going to be at Marlins Park. You can go there to taste the dishes at 6 p.m. get the ticket information and our social media, WLRN Sundial. It's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much, everybody, and best of luck to you guys.
Thank you so much.
And that's our program for this Monday, February 25th. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow.